Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's September 26th, 2021, and welcome to episode 242 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and networking, and other such things. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston. I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. The first of whom is joining us specially today, Ian Baranofsky in Austin, Texas. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. How's the weather there?
It's getting less hot. That's always a good thing. Pretty hot Texas summers here.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Also joining me is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm good. It's lovely to be here, and it is actually especially lovely outside. Not as hot, it sounds like, as it is for Ian. But yeah, it's been a shockingly, it's starting to feel like a nice, not quite crisp, but autumn is in the air. So it's been a nice outdoor weekend with for me and my daughter. So yeah, good stuff. Glad to be here, cool. As always.
Cool. Yeah. And I guess I'm next in the northern leading progression, and it's also nice here. I mean, it is cooling down. It's really nice.
Yeah. Nice and arid. There's not really any humidity, and the sun is sunny, but you know, there's no humidity. It's been a pleasure to be outside. I gotta say, I did nothing retro computing related today. I was outside all day, so there you go.
Congratulations. And lastly, Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
Cold here. Also, I'm fantastic.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not apocalyptic here, but it's not hot anymore, and I don't like it. I'm not allowed to complain about the heat, because I will incessantly complain about the cold. Yeah. Starting shortly and going for the next 6 months. Yep. I do not like the cold. So it's like 16 or 17 degrees. I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit. Nobody knows American temperatures. But it is
unknowable.
It's the sort of temperature that feels incredibly cold because it's fall, but would feel incredibly warm if it was May. It's that temperature. Yeah. But since it's fall, it's annoying.
Do we think that Toronto or Boston is the colder place? I honestly don't know.
In my heart?
Boston's north. Yeah.
I don't know. I guess I would have thought Toronto.
I would have thought us as well.
Okay.
We're right on a lake. We're Canadians.
Yeah.
Got a lot of hockey rinks and that reduce.
Lots of maple syrup. Maple syrup. Pancakes all the time.
Yes.
They do this thing in Montreal where they take, like, it's basically like snow that you put maple syrup on. It freezes into little, like, candy things.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of cool.
And they take French fries and they pour this gravy on them. It's weird. They put this cheese.
Perfect.
I don't know. It's got a weird name.
I saw this like a pizza with this on it. It seems like that's sort of pushing it a bit. But anyway,
We're ganging up on Canada.
No judgment.
The snow thing you were talking about is called maple taffy, and it is a delicacy up here. But yes, pour maple syrup on snow, roll it up, eat it. Welcome to Canada.
Very cool.
We're eating the environment.
Eating extremely yellow snow, I guess, beyond yellow.
Although in Canada, sometimes the environment eats you, so it's only fair.
That's right. Okay, here we are. It's been a little while since we've recorded. The topic that we had intended to talk about this time is retro networking. And so maybe we can sort of pivot to that and talk about that. I have various things that I can say about that, but I will go not first. Who would like to go actually first?
I don't volunteer because I'm not exactly sure if you're talking about retro social networking or retro networking on vintage hardware.
Ah, that's interesting.
That even occurred to me. I was wondering if we were talking about networking back in the day on computers or networking now on old computers. I didn't even consider it social networking because who does social stuff? We're podcasters. We're nerds.
That's right.
That's right. Time for social.
But yeah, I suppose it could well be like, you know, handshake events at, you know, VCF East or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But. Yeah. I think what I'm going to talk about involves a tiny bit of the social, so we'll see.
Then I think you're going first, Blake.
Good thought, Ian. Am I going first? Okay.
Yeah, you are.
Well, what I interpreted this to mean is we all have, and this happens many times, I think, we have a host topic and we've all come from rather different directions, right. Which probably makes for a fairly interesting, sort of ball of, yeah. What is that? Katamari ball of, you know, of subject of opinions.
It's like dung beetles.
Yes, exactly. Dung beetles. Katamari like a large bowl of retro dung ball. Yes. So we found the topic, this title, subtitle for the show. I interpret it as, you know, I guess today what I'm doing with my vintage computers in the networking, you know, data sharing capacity that maybe I couldn't or didn't before because of reasons, some of the reasons being money, some of the reasons being, you know, the lack of these really nice, cheap, fast devices that are, you know, coming out left and right for all these vintage systems that enables things that you couldn't have done. Or if you did it in the past, you did it more slowly and it cost like, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. It does really seem like a golden age of retro computing, given how many devices are coming out. But we've echoed that, I think, with a lot of our host topics. So, yeah, just talk about some of the things. I mean, I remember early on when I actually became sort of like a vintage computing, you know, hobbyist, Apple IIgs was the first system I picked up. I'd had it in my past, and I remember I used a Mac as a like a non OS X Mac as a Apple Share file share over serial. I guess AppleTalk. There's EtherTalk and AppleTalk. The AppleTalk. This was over serial basically.
Yeah, AppleTalk is the local talk is the
local talk.
Physical protocol, and AppleTalk is what they named the networking protocol when they came out with EtherTalk, so you could separate them.
Okay. Yes, local talk. So I had, you know, I had the a serial cable going, you know, from my 2GS, no special hardware, into the serial port on a, you know, a Mac. I download from the internet things on the Mac and FTP, or actually, I guess it shared a folder at this, you know, and drag it across. Mm-hmm. Since then, just to use that as a starting point, I've added a inexpensive Ethernet card to the Apple 2GS, so it's on the LAN. I can FTP. To FTP sites out there, but usually I will, you know, kind of amass things on the system I'm using here, my iMac, and then it has a little, I've set up a little, basically I set up a little FTP server that's local in the house, you know, unprotected to, you know, send files to the GS, so Ethernet, they're all wired, some of the other machines behind me, I've just equipped, these are Ethernet interfaces that didn't exist anywhere in the zone of when these machines were contemporary. You know, the Amiga 2000 behind me has a Ethernet interface. I mean, there's a 486 box. That's not so, you know, hard to get an Ethernet card into. I don't consider that really even retro networking because there's always been, you know, network cards for PCs. It's running DOS, but still. I have, like, for the TI-99 to my left over the shoulder, I have a device called a TippyPeb. It's a TI peripheral expansion box, basically an interface card that goes in the large box upon which you mount a Raspberry Pi. I have a Raspberry Pi 3. It provides networking. It emulates a hard disk, emulates a floppy disks. It ties into a proprietary little network that the author created. You know, so there's networking there. All the machines I mentioned, I will use, and this perhaps ties into Ian's mention of the social side. One of the things I like to do is BBS, you know, because, and we've talked about this before, Telnet BBSs, sometimes with a dial-up component, are there's a lot of them out there today if you want to relive that thing, bulletin board systems, text-based. So I use all these systems, you know, just for fun. I vary it to BBS and use IRC. Like, I back to my left, I have 6 open IRC channels. I'm always connected to IRC, which, again, is a rather old, an aged social, sort of a chat room type thing. And all these machines, it's fun to do that on those machines. I look at it as a way of, any way to use these old machines in some fashion rather than just look at them or, you know, play a game, that feels like that's what retro, you know, enjoyment for me is. And just briefly, I guess I'll mention, you know, there are I've done more simple, you know, I have a Raspberry Pi laptop that I've sort of put together using parts from a mobile, like a Motorola Android phone setup. Instead of the Android phone, it's got a Raspberry Pi, has a serial cable on it, and for systems that I want to get hooked to the my network that don't really have Ethernet, I can do
It's a Motorola. I have the exact same thing.
Yeah, I've got it somewhere in. You can.
I just held up mine.
Viewers can probably see it behind me. I have a. That's my slowest Pi. And Paul is holding up the laptop Motorola, which was meant to be a dock for a Android phone. And when you plug it in, it would shift out of Android mode and into some sort of, you know, generic Linux GUI, you know, thing, which is cool. But anyway, it was cheap to get the laptop, and with the Raspberry Pi, it makes it generic and flexible. So I'll carry that around and set it down on top of the monitor of one of the systems. I have USB to serial adapter on it, so I can plug in. I can get it talking via serial to basically any system with the right cable, and I've got, you know, boxes of the right cables. So after a fashion, I'm able to basically, you know, network any of the machines, and I guess, you know, while it's fun to BBS and do these things, the real enabling thing is simply moving files, because you often don't, like, oh, here's a new thing that came out for this machine that someone wrote on the internet. The difficulty in, you know, if you're going to physically somehow write that out to media that could be read by these machines, that would be, you know, ridiculously hard, compared to, you know, just using network hardware or carrying this little laptop around, in my opinion. I mean, I think there are, you know, floppy writer devices and other alternatives, but that's, you know, so that's basically a rundown of, you know, what I have going on as far as, you know, retro networking. There's no machine I had before, probably, you know, 92 or 93, had any sort of networking at all that enabled. Like, there was nothing. It was all, you know, aside from dialing up on a modem, you know, that was, I had modem dial up for quite a while. So these are, you know, I had most of the machines I have now, I had different, you know, the same, you know, units, and now I've reacquired different ones, but all the systems that I'm using now networking, I never had the opportunity, for, as I said, various reasons to, enjoy networking on them before. So it's I'm kind of getting a bigger use today in certain respects than I could have in the past. So that's basically my overall for what I got to say about that.
In order to balance out, Blake, I'd say I have the big goose egg on networking. I really have barely tried to get online with retro computers. I have a Wi-Fi adapter for Commodore computers for C64. And I got so far as trying to connect, and then I realized I didn't have a terminal program for the C64.
Right.
It just didn't work out. And for me, moving files around is more a matter of using flash adapters and flash cards, and, you know, but networking is a bit above my pay grade. So I really haven't. I haven't connected multiple computers either, multiple retro computers. But I really do want to do some BBSing on an Apple II. Although the most popular Ethernet card requires a cable, and I'm kind of hoping someone will put something out that will enable Wi-Fi easily. Or, you know, there was some promise of things like the VidHD supporting adding additional functionality, which never came to pass so far. But there are, I think that was the most promising, because I think that had a Pi device or a similar computer on it, that right. VidHD that had Wi-Fi yeah. access. So
yeah, the hardware is there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have been confronting a lot of this stuff just recently, because I've been sort of setting up my computers around my environment. So I set up the next station, and that's sort of like that's designed to be on the network. I mean, like it wants it defaults to net booting, you know. So I kind of wanted to get that working, but I guess I was also sort of just thinking a lot about. What do I want to get out of this? You know, like that was in a sense that, you know, Blake, you were sort of hitting that a little bit, that do I really want these on the network? So I have a Duo. Is that the best example? What is a good example? iMac G4. I set up that, right? And that one, that's fairly modern. It has an actual Ethernet jack in it, right? And so I spent a little bit of time setting up a Raspberry Pi to do a bridge. So it's got the Wi-Fi and it connects to my router, but it just bridges the internet to its Ethernet port. That's actually pretty cool. You know, so I can just plug in the Raspberry Pi to the iMac and it is on my Wi-Fi network. And then nothing loads because everything is HTTPS and like this doesn't know how to talk to it. Everything says, I can't talk to this. We have no encryption technology in common. Mm-hmm. And all of the net is like this now. So I'm not sure that I actually want all of these machines on my Wi-Fi network, because, you know, they're not getting security updates and I can't read anything anyway. Really, file sharing is it. File sharing is the thing I want to do. So
how did you end up solving that? Because I've got the iMac G4 and I've got it file sharing with my current Mac. So what did you do?
I haven't gotten too much further than that. I mean, like there's actually, I came across one thing, what was it called? I can't remember, but it was basically, we may have even talked about it here, but it runs and it basically mines the Internet Archive. And so what you do is you browse the web as if it were, you know, 1998, and it will just follow, it'll just get all of its web information from the Internet Archive. And so it'll look like it looked like on that computer in 1998. And that's a really cool thing. That's one of the next things I want to try to set up when I'm actually using these things. Mm-hmm.
The way back machine.
Yeah, exactly.
So and it does it without, there's no SSL. It's just open as far as what it presents to you. You don't have to be able to decrypt SSL.
Right. I mean, I think it runs on a, how does that work? I think it runs on a modern machine and feeds, I'm not sure quite exactly how it feeds it. I think it's a server. Like, so you connect to it. Maybe it's a proxy. I'm not sure. I haven't quite set it up yet, but that's, I think that's what I want. If I want these things to be on the web, I want to be able to see Yahoo 1999, you know, I don't want to interact with Facebook and all the like JavaScript windows and stuff.
Yeah. I guess maybe I should have specified. So the systems that I'm, you know, using networked, I think are old to the point, like I'm not actually talking about like a G3 or a G4 Mac, you know, and certainly nothing running OS 10. I think, you know, the most modern system that I'm doing it is probably the, the DOS, I guess the DOS, you know, 586, and then the accelerated Amiga 2000, neither of them, you know, you could install Windows 95 on the DOS box, and you could, you know, run a browser that will, you know, decode SSL, but of course, I think maybe not the current iteration, but I'm not actually trying to do, and I don't do the web on any of these things. Like I think the, you know, for kicks, you know, the accelerated Amiga, there is a TCP/IP stack, which I use, you know, to transfer files, but it also has a really weak browser, JavaScript or, pages look ridiculous, but it'll load them. But yeah, there's so not a point. I mean, just the time it takes to load a small JPEG image, mm-hmm. Even with the 680/20 accelerator. So yeah, I'm not trying to do the web. I don't want to do the web. I guess, I mentioned IRC, BBSing, these are all text-based FTP. I haven't tried to take it further. And, I don't. And for almost all these systems, Thomas Terry Holm, has created the inner client for Plato, which right. is sort of it's a graphical thing. And that's about as far as these machines can handle that. And that's about as far as I've gone. So yeah, the web, it sounds like the instance you described is a little bit more media machine, I guess. Is that you're talking like a G3, G4? Well, not your Duo. Your Duo wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what you call that, a G1. I don't know. It was like a 603 or something like that. It was
603, 604. Yeah. PowerPC.
It was like the very first one. So we talked about that before. You moved up to PowerPC and everything became half as fast.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the one that I feel actually sort of safest about just putting it straight on my Wi-Fi network is the 2GS, because it is unattackable.
Yeah. Like if it did get attacked, you'd kind of want it to happen. You'd want to know who did it. Like you'd be like, I want to meet this person. Someone just hacked my Apple 2GS, and clearly they were intending specifically to do that. So
it was Antoine Vigneault.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. No doubt. Yeah.
Anyway, I can cede the floor here. Carrington, did you have any networking thoughts?
The only vintage computer I use now is my iMac G4, so a similar situation for you, but I wasn't interested in getting it on the internet. I was interested in getting files onto it more easily when I download them from Macintosh Garden or whatever, and I boot it to Mac OS 9, and it turns out the networking is incredibly easy because it's got Ethernet. I just plug Ethernet into my router, turned on file sharing. My Mac OS 10 computers just saw it because, yep, there's that sharing, and just copy files over. It's crazy that AFP still works between I'm on Mojave on this computer, I think, or who knows what it's called. And it can just see a Mac OS 9 computer if you just turn on file sharing, and it just seamlessly works between them. That's insane to me. When you were talking about the LocalTalk stuff, though, that brought up a real memory of mine. I had moved a number of different print shops to change from paste-up systems to desktop publishing back in the late 80s and into early 90s. So people would purchase a bunch of Macintosh 2CI computers and would want to network everything together, not to share files, but to share printers. A lot of people forget how incredibly expensive everything was. So you'd buy your 2CI printer that would be $7,000 or $9,000 once you put RAM in it, plus you needed to pay for your monitor and stuff. So you'd be sitting in front of a $12,000 computer in 1990 money, like just a $22,000 stations, and a laser printer was another $7,000. You weren't putting one of those on everybody's desk. So to network them together, we would use LocalTalk. And then eventually for most of the systems I set up, we switched over to Farallon's thing, the phone net, which was just LocalTalk, but instead of using Apple's more expensive little connections and regular cables, you'd use a phone cable. And the neat thing about the Farallon systems mm-hmm. is it uses a regular twisted pair RJ11. But it only uses two of the four cables and same like a regular mm-hmm. phone line. So usually it would be on the same thing. We'd have a phone system and you could just rewire it and say, okay, those two are your network and those two are your phone. And that's how you'd go from floor to floor. And it was super simple. Yeah. You didn't have to terminate anything. I had no idea. I was the networking guy to do this. And I had no idea how shielded I was from real networking. That these computers would mm-hmm. just plug everything together. Don't worry about terminating. Don't worry about setting anything. It would just automatically be given user readable names, and it would just work easily for 100 stations. And I had no idea that I really had no idea how to network anything. And I was just a little Apple fanboy who knew how to plug stuff together. Remarkable how little I knew about networking for a guy who was being paid to network computers. So that was crazy. But yeah, I was a big fan of local Talk stuff, like Apple Talk, and then eventually Ether Talk, right up until the internet became the way everybody wanted to communicate, and that kind of killed it. But really, until then, it was all just local talk things. Did a lot of that.
Yeah, and I'll clarify. I actually, with the GS that I mentioned, where I was using local talk, I rearranged the room, and the GS became much farther away. And so I went on eBay and grabbed an unopened little pair of those Farallon adapters, and was using phone net. That's what it was called.
Phone net.
I was using the RJ11. Yeah. Which was much cheaper, and I could get, had 50-foot cables laying around already. So,
Paul Hand is holding up for our audio podcast. Those of you listening at home, Paul is holding it up. The other weird networking thing I remember that today seems like a crazy thing to do is have a lot of one-slot Mac computers. You got Mac SE. And so if you're using the port, the one slot for something else, the way we would network them is with a SCSI adapter. So a lot of the Asante SCSI adapters, and it would give you SCSI to Ethernet. And I did a ton of that. And to me, it seems crazy to say, okay, we're going to network over your SCSI port. But I did a lot of that, and it was great. And it's still, if you've got like a Mac LC with an Apple IIe card in it, those things are an amazing way to get them networked, because you can use your basically unused SCSI port. Because who uses SCSI anymore? You get all these SD card adapters. Yeah. Your SCSI's unused. It makes a great port for networking if you can get one of those. They've gotten really expensive on eBay, though, because everybody knows to buy them now.
Right. I have a Mac Plus behind me, and I use the Asante ENSC device to do that. And I know a friend of mine, I guess it was back in like the early 90s when we were both in college, he happened to be going to Columbia University in New York, and he all the Mac people anyway at the time, he was this must have been like 95 or actually no, it was like 92, 93. They if you had a Mac, they would give you it was by default, you'd get a SCSI based Ethernet adapter. It wasn't the Asante unit, it was some other thing I'd never heard of, but everyone had that. That's how networking was done if you had a Mac and you went to Columbia that year, anyway. So I thought that was interesting.
Cool.
It worked well.
One of the things that I was doing, like thinking about when I was setting this up, I'm still on the fence about this, but even if I do get everything that's sort of connected to a network, I was thinking about having a separate router that is only just my, that isn't actually connected to the outside world. But so if I'm going to, I could serve something off the next that I could then, read on my Duo or something, but without actually having to get outside that, that might be sort of fun. As a proof of concept of something.
That's also, a lot of people try to do things in a way that is period appropriate. But there were a lot of networks I remember being on and using that would be a local network, like a local talk network. And then you would use a local talk to Ethernet bridge to get onto the internet or whatever. You'd have that one point that says, well, this network is a physical thing. And we jump through that gate to get onto the other floor or out to the world at large.
Right. Yeah, I remember I had one of the networking, I guess a failure, it didn't really work out, is I have a Newton message pad, 2100, and it's got the nice two PC MCA slots, and you got your linear flash card in the one, and then you've got Ethernet in the other, or actually Wi-Fi. I ended up with a Wi-Fi card, and so I was trying to get it connected, but it turns out it's not going to connect to the encryption of modern, I have pretty hefty router.
Yeah, it's going to be 802.11.a or whatever, some early thing where it's like, I don't think so.
Right. There's no SEP, so I had to do, I did set up like a really old route, a Wi-Fi thing, to try to get it to connect, and theoretically it should have, because it didn't, it was wide open. Like,
for all you war dialers out there, if you go near Blake's house, he has a wide open unsecure network.
But I still couldn't get it panned out, and then I'm like, well, if it does work, I've still got this wide open thing, sitting in my house, it's not practical, so I just sort of, it's like, maybe I don't need to, be on the Newton.
Stick like your 2GS on it and call Antoine and say, I've got a project for you.
I had
one of my iMac G4s, I think, had a Wi-Fi in it, and so it could serve as a bridge.
Like,
it could broadcast.
Airport? What's it called? Airport cards? I think they were called. Cool.
So I had in my office at one point, I had that set up where the iMac was, there's just a setting, you know, it says share your internet. You know, you can share the internet from the Ethernet to the Wi-Fi, and then all the other period appropriate Macs could connect to the G4 that was broadcasting the Ethernet.
Cool.
So anyway, yeah, lots of things to try, but, okay. Are there more things we wanted to talk about networking?
Social networking.
Go to Canada. Social networking. Yeah. That's right. So 6 months of the year, we talk about how it's cold in Toronto. And the other 6 months, we talk about how Kansas Fest is either coming or is over.
Right. There you go. Welcome to the RCR.
Basically.
Retrocompute.
Yeah. So I've been setting up all these Raspberry Pis I have a bunch of them and they have Wi-Fi connectivity. And so I've set up a bunch of these little things that I can just sort of plug in as bridges to my regular Wi-Fi. Not everything plays nicely. So like I've done this a couple times and what ends up happening is that my various Macs are modern Macs around the place announce there's somebody else on the network with your same name. We're going to change your name now to that name two.
Oh, or that right. Name, and you end up with five. Six. Right.
And it's like, I don't know what they're doing. Something is missed. There's some instability in the network that this is generating that I'm not very happy with. But anyway, yeah, it turns out that old things are complicated.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Old things, yeah. More and more.
I do often sort of feel like, knowing what we know now, it should make all of this easier, but it isn't. You know, IRQs and SCSI termination and all that stuff is just as annoying as it ever was.
That's why everybody dropped it all.
Yeah. So I think we'll just move into items of interest and news. And Blake, you have the first uplifting item of interest.
Okay. Sadly, I think about a week ago, Sir Clive Sinclair died at age 81. Sir Clive was behind a number of notable and interesting technology items. I think most relevant to our podcast here is the what became, I guess, the ZX, the ZX Spectrum, the Spectrum line of machines, or the, I guess first there was the ZX80. The ZX81, which saw sales in America as the Timex Sinclair 1000, and then I guess the big success story unit would be the ZX Spectrum with color at an inexpensive price. I think in Europe, it was certainly UK. Certainly, it was might have been the most popular. In other words, Commodore 64. ZX Spectrum and I think less, Apple, there were some others, Acorn. Actually, Acorn kind of branched, as told in the movie Micromen and other, historical sources, kind of branched out of his organization. But anyway, so he sadly passed away, age of 81. Some of the other things that he was behind was that I heard it stated that he invented the electronic calculator, and I think that was clarified. I believe that's not the case. He did release what was perhaps the first truly pocketable calculator, and then there's some variations of of that fact or notion, but there was a Sinclair pocket calculator that was easy to carry around. He also developed a sort of a electric, it was one of the first, not actually one of the first, it was a three-wheel electric vehicle. I learned in looking at his history that there actually were some electric vehicles decades and decades earlier. He was very much behind this device, the C5, the vehicle, but it was never a success. I think he was always sort of frustrated that never really caught. And there were some other devices that Sinclair put out, I think, a small portable television, a few other electronic devices. But I think the ZX Spectrum is what introduced a lot of people in the UK to, you know, computing, and that's that's quite an accomplishment, I think. As far as a historical thing, as far as home computing and where those, you know, where things came from. And again, as I said, you know, ARM kind of sort of competitively resulted or skewed out of Sinclair, and you know, we're all using, we have several ARM devices in different places on our body, and everywhere that you look there's more than one. That same ARM. Sad to see his passing, but notable figure to be sure.
Mm-hmm. That C5 is just so delightful looking. I mean, like what's the people mover? What is that called? The thing that Steve Wozniak likes so much.
The Segway.
Yeah, and it was basically just Segway. Yeah, it was basically just like the police force that took to him, and that was about it.
Yeah.
Pogo stick with wheels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It actually, if you look, images of this three wheel C5 can be found all over the net. Yeah, it also looks sort of like a suicide device. Like you're not at all enclosed. You're much lower than the vehicles around you. It's almost as if you're, you know, it's you want, you know, I like a little gamble when I go out for my ride for work. You know, to like a little sport to it.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a scary but amazing sort of thing. And he was really behind it. He knew that this was going to change everything, but it did not.
I like how it's sort of like a capsule coffin. Everybody shows Sir Clive in, you know, when they have these articles about his unfortunate death.
Yeah. He did some amazing, we don't need to go on about it here, but like if you look on YouTube for some ads, some of the Spectrum ads, I mean, he did some amazing ones. I think there's one where he leapfrogs over a variety of towers in a field that represent different home computers, and they have him physically jumping over these things. It's a staggering sort of ad. It really would have been something to see it at the time in context.
That is a pretty hilarious ad. I keep coming across because, like, you know, I have to search for the audio ads to put in the show, and so I come across that one relatively frequently.
But, I know that sitting here in the U.S., you know, using like the Apple II and the TI, it was pretty amazing to read about what, you know, the colors and the kind of the what the ZX Spectrum could do at the time. You know, I would read about them in like Creative Computing magazine, different magazines. I learned much more about it with some UK gaming magazines I've been subscribing to for like 15 years. But it was, you know, more than just another Z80, you know, based computer. It was impressive what they for the money, what you got, it was quite the thing.
All right, let's see. So next we have Carrington has an adventure based thing.
We all have this thing, I think. Everybody chose this.
It was pretty funny
alphabetically.
Yep.
So this is Arctic Adventure. It is very cool. So Harry McCracken, a lot of people will know his name, was the tech editor, I think, for Fast Company. Kind of got famous again in the late 2000s. That sounds like a future thing, but it's in the past. I don't know, 2005, whatever you'd call that. For refusing to, I think he quit Fast Company or something because the editor was pressuring them to not publish something bad about Apple, and Apple was a big sponsor. So he's like, I'm a journalist, and quit. And so I always like that story, however apocryphal. But he, way back as a kid in 1980, wrote and had published a book or a game called Arctic Adventure. It was a text adventure, highly influenced by the Scott Adams adventures. This is one of those two-word parsers, go north, kill dragon, that sort of thing. Had it published in something called the Captain 80 Book of Basic Adventures, which is available, I'm showing it online right now, available on the Internet Archive, and got paid for it. It got published, and the only really feedback Harry got was somebody writing in to him saying, your game doesn't work. So, and then, you know, went on and did other things, and, you know, it was a little game that got published and what have you. But in recent times, what happens is, for some reason, I think it came back up again, or he found another copy of things, and then looked through the code and found that in the published version, yes, there was a missing zero in one thing, like in a go-to or something like that, which made the game broken and unplayable. And whether that was a typo on his part or in the editor or whatever, the published version was unplayable. And Mr. McCracken thought, well, why don't I just make it available now? So it has become available. So you can go over to arctic81.com and you can play the game online. And so right now, if I'm here and I just press enter, then now I'm playing the game. So you don't have to download anything or whatever. It's a text adventure for early teens. Here is 80 computers, but you just go to the website, play the game, and it's really cool. It's neat that this is a game kind of got rediscovered after 40 years or what have you, and then was corrected by changing one character, and that made it available, and it's a whole neat story. So that is my choice of neat news, because I love text adventures, I love games, I love refound old goodies. So the question is, have any of you actually played this yet?
Not beyond what you just did.
Okay.
But, I thought it was kind of cool that it is somebody, it's sort of someone who's like moderately famous, you know, that wrote this thing. I suppose famous in a computer world, so maybe it's not super surprising. But, and I think if I remember reading this, he typed it in himself. Like he didn't have a copy, he typed it in. It was later found on a tape, but not before he had actually typed it in.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. So the Captain 80 book of adventures, basic adventures. So you type in. I mean, I am well familiar with books of basic games, and I typed in plenty of them back in the day. But so you type in the adventure, correct? I mean, the whole thing was in the book, and you type it in, and then you'd run it.
Yes.
Okay, it seems like would you think, or do you know if there had been any sort of obfuscation? It seems like if you're typing an adventure game in, it would have to take something, like you'd get your friend to type it in so that you didn't know what you were going to encounter, or I guess you could obfuscate.
Well, not really. I don't know if you've ever typed any of these in, but generally because it's basic and they're trying to shrink things down, there's usually a big chunk of data that's just okay, type
data
this,
statements.
Load the, and just a whole bunch of letters and things which tell you which rooms you can go to and not. And so in the nature of the game itself, there'll be some obscuring of things, because you'll read the thing and say, oh, the bat poisons you or whatever, but you won't necessarily know that it's because you went in a certain room. And these games are generally so simplistic, it really is just the fact that you pick up the melon, therefore the bat attacks you or something. And so you can't necessarily know from the code, just by a cursory glance, what not to do. Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess if you wanted, you literally could use data statements to put a cipher. you could have something rotate the. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, I guess so. It just struck me as I was picturing typing this in. You're like, you won the game. Oh wait, what is what line points to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Well, if you were typing in something in PETSCII on your pet. Mm-hmm. Then you might be able to guess at what the graphics look like, but when it all comes together with peaks and pokes, it would probably be a big surprise.
Yeah.
Maybe so. I think you're probably right.
Cool.
Yeah. I will. I do want to play it. I saw this cross.
Yeah. I'll 100% play it. I love text adventures. So of course I'm going to play it. Mm-hmm. Probably try to convince Kay to review it with me on Uneaten by a Grue or something. It's like, come on, let's dive in.
Sounds like a podcast episode.
Does
there.
Indeed. Yeah.
However, I think Harry McCracken himself did warn us that this was an adventure game written by a kid. It's not probably quite Infocom level, but.
And does that make it better or worse than a Scott Adams adventure?
Probably better.
Yeah, good question. now. And I guess the next item of interest is Ian's.
Yeah, so VCF Midwest happened recently, and there were very quickly some of the presentations put online. Pretty good quality videos on YouTube. There are several definitely interesting videos, and this one caught my eye because of my involvement with the Applesauce archival project. And it's a talk about 45 minutes long about recovering floppy disks using an oscilloscope, which sounds a little more down in the weeds than one might think, but it's pretty interesting. They seem like they're doing a lot of good work in their own realm, trying to recover BBC micro disks and unique developer disks and source code. But basically what they talk about is finding these test points on the disk drive analog board, little TP points, putting a oscilloscope leads on it, mm-hmm. and trying to increase the amplification of the signal coming out of damaged parts of floppy disks. And it's very interesting how far they got and how much success they had by doing this, because what they're really trying to do is sidestep vintage hardware that had limited preamplification or amplification of the signal coming off of the floppy disk. So I think, being involved in the Applesauce project, it seems like John Morris, the creator of Applesauce, he's done a lot of what they're doing in software. They talk about the speaker talks about, literally writing down the flux transitions and modifying them himself, which is actually a functionality of the Applesauce client. But, I think John Morris has moved towards machine learning quite a bit more than some of the work these guys have done. But these guys are definitely doing interesting and novel work to try to recover as much data as possible. I think one of my main criticisms with the video is it makes it sound sort of scary to do disk recovery. I mean, I would say it's one of those things that you should jump into. Although they're correct in saying you don't want to jump in with your first disk being a unique right. source code or unreleased piece right. of software. But you just got to get in there and start doing it, and you might ruin a few disks. But I've been surprised at how few disks I've ruined.
We all have.
I'm surprised at how much data you can get off of most floppies and off of most magnetic media. So, yeah, I think this is definitely a good video to check out.
Yeah, it does seem pretty interesting to sort of see what kinds of failure modes there are and how you can possibly see past them. But yeah, the Applesauce device and software client does show you a fair amount of these, like this kind of graph, the flux transitions and things, and it's interesting. It feels a little beyond me, but
yeah, occasionally Applesauce will throw an error at you in a read that you make that will tell you that it's something like, I don't remember the exact wording of the message, but it's like user can correct flux transitions, like user could if user had any idea what was going on.
Right.
But, at that point I go straight to the Slack and ask for help.
Yeah, but it's still, it's amazing that you could learn and then you could use this to do that. And that was always sort of my hope for this thing, was that you could, for things that were actually broken, you could do a little bit of surgery and manage to recover things that only a few bits were messed up on.
Well, disk repair is coming if you, in Applesauce, I'm not sure how it's going to work, but if you have two copies of the same fluxed software, it's going to be able to combine two images to make up for the two different, if they have missing data in different places. So that's going to be an interesting functionality for Applesauce.
Yeah, that's it's all amazing magic.
Yes.
All right, let's see. I have the next thing, sort of. It's from feedback. Actually, the next thing that I really had was Arctic Adventure, but
tell us about it.
However, Carrington already told us about it. So the next thing is the PAL one. This is something that Tony wrote over email to tell us about. It is a Kim 1 clone kit. And, you know, basically it's, you know, I don't have a lot to say about it except that, you know, it's a kit. It's a $80 kit. Oh, it's out of stock. Well, okay, that's cool. But when it becomes in stock, it looks like a kind of a fun thing to do. The Kim 1 is a relatively simple 6502, you know, support machine. So it has a little keypad and digital, you know, display. And this is a kit that lets you build a replica of it. And it's not super expensive to do. So if you're interested in that sort of thing, this is a kit for you.
Looks like another kit for me to buy and not assemble.
Yeah.
But this looks really doable. This is not a huge kit. It's not a replica of an Apple One that, you know, that'll take 16 hours of soldering. This is probably a medium kit, and considering how basic the Kim 1 was, you know, as a board, this looks you know, relatively similar to what an actual Kim 1 looks like, and would probably be a pretty cool toy to have sitting around to play with.
Does anyone here have a Kim 1? I do not have a Kim 1.
I do not. Be surprised.
Okay.
Want?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind, you know, if somebody found one in their basement and handed it to me, but these things are not easily acquired otherwise.
And let's face it, not particularly useful.
No.
I mean, come on, what are you going to do with a Kim 1?
Yeah. Does it even, I guess
network you can,
it won't even run Arctic Adventure.
That's right. I mean, I guess it has those little LED displays that you might be able to control. It's the same kind of thing that you would do with the ET3400, you know, like,
okay,
I've written a program on one of those that will, like, spin a little thing. Actually, when I say written, I mean I typed it in from the manual.
Well, you learned a lot from that.
I did. I don't remember any of it.
Curtis makes a good point in the chat, though, like, as much as I disparage the Kim 1 about, like, you know, what would you do with it? But he's right. It's very much a historically significant computer. But then I figure if you want it for its historical significance, you would want an actual one.
Yeah.
It seems like it would be fun. Like, you could sort of, you know, I'm going to type in a little program that will count in binary and skip every other number or something and watch that happen.
Right.
I mean, I guess, you know, like a desk toy or something, in a way. I mean, I guess people actually used it. I mean, it was a demo. It was like a sales driver for this 6502, right? Sort of?
Right.
Good point. Yes.
For some people. It's
like those development platforms or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sort of, one of those.
Oh, we're going to build a system. Here's the easy way. It's actually wired up.
It's a 6502 trainer. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. I wonder if it'll take a 6.5 CO2. I wonder, like, what would happen. Would that work? It should, right?
Super Kim.
It'll have mouse text.
Yeah,
that's right. <I get it>. Mouse text on the little 7-segment display.
Why is there no mouse text?
Anyway, okay, that'll be that for that. Blake, you have the next thing.
Okay, just another item for me is, we've talked about this before, it was an item of mine, Big Mess O'Wires is working on a drive controller, floppy controller for the Apple II that will control a large array of drives, and it's gotten to the point, apparently it's called the Yellowstone device, and it's been it sounds like it's in the hands of testers. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not an available thing as far as I understand as yet, but it apparently is getting very close. I thought it was pretty, you know, rather impressive, the capabilities that they've gotten to at this point. Right now, apparently, it is, let's see, it's compatible, it'll work on the Apple II Plus, IIe, 2GS, and it's compatible with every 5 1/4 inch or 3 1/2 inch drive used on any Apple II or Macintosh, excepting the original 400K single-sided Macintosh floppy drive. So these, even if you've taken a drive out of a Mac SE or something and you're using it laying on the table, Unidisk 3.5, Apple 3.5 inch drive, disk 2, Unidisk 5 1/4, anything, it will drive. And apparently it, let's see, when you mix and match smart port and standard drive units, you can have 5 drives connected. It apparently will handle tricky copy protected disk protection scheme. So very impressive. It sounds like it's this update indicates that it's rather close to release, and so this is just another update on that. And yeah, so it works with the floppy emu, the W drive, some other, you know, other floppy emulators. So seems like quite a device, certainly a useful device to have on hand as far as, you know, utilizing disk, you know, floppy drive reading needs down the road, because you can use basically anything that you throw at it. So so there you go. Good on them, and that'll be something that I'm sure I'll end up buying one while the buying is good when it comes out.
I don't understand. I'm just a simple Texas lawyer, but can you explain to me why? Like, I don't understand.
Why do you need this?
I
knew I recognized you from somewhere.
I don't. Am I slow? What is the reason I want this?
Well, you want to have one thing. You want is an Apple II with a slot.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, but let's say an Apple II with a slot. I can right now. I can plug in the regular drives, the 3 1/4 mm-hmm. or 5 1/4 or 3 1/2 inch standard mm-hmm. floppy drives. Especially, I want the 5 1/4 because like all the software for the Apple II came on that. So if I switch over, like Jeremy's asking in the comments, does it work with the 1.4 megabyte super drive? Let's say it does. What does it get me? Like no Apple II software came
on
that.
And it does, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually it does in 800K mode. I think I read in the bit about it. So it's not going to give you 1.4 megabyte.
Actually, that you mentioned it, I recall that as well. Yeah.
So what is the point? Just so that I can save like a larger amount of data of my own to the floppy disk? Like that's the point of it?
Well, this could be a reductive question. Why do I need to use an Apple II at all? But
No. I mean, if I did have one, like say I had one, what is the advantage of this over just like the standard? Because the regular stuff, like the floppy disk card, the controller card, mm-hmm. and the 5 1/4 inch disks are readily available incredibly cheaply. So right. If I've already got those, why would I want to chuck out that card and switch to the Yellowstone? I'm not saying there isn't a reason. I'm just saying I don't understand it. What is the thing that it gives me?
Well, one thing it does give you – okay. In principle, it gives you access to 3 1/2 inch drives, right? Okay. And so we think, you know, why would you want that? Because like almost nothing except for like for the 2GS or 2C Plus came out on 3 1/2 inch drives, the disks, right? But what the one thing they do have is more space, and the floppy emu emulates a 3 1/2 inch drive, and so this is a way that you can plug a floppy emu into an Apple II Plus.
Okay.
Right? So otherwise you would need to get one of these rare Lyron cards or something to do that.
Those things are rare and expensive, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Right. So it enables, that's probably, I guess I'd agree that's the biggest thing, because right, it's hard. The Lyron card is, there are very, very rare, right? And crazy expensive, as I understand it. But also, I guess I was picturing like, I don't know, if you have a large array of hardware, like you can use some of these, you know, maybe you have spare Mac, you know, Mac parts, you know, you can hook up multiple, you know, these Macintosh drives. Yeah, it seems like more like a utility belt kind of thing. I mean, it has the big feature that Paul mentioned, but also, you know, if you've got a bunch of stuff sitting around and you suffer a series of Apple II disk drive failures, you can always reach for that Mac and pull the drive out of it. Yeah, it's certainly not a I think it gets to what Ian was saying. You know, if you've got the Apple II, you're already, you know,
okay, I think it was a mindset thing, because I think of, in modern days, floppy disks as being such an unreliable source to save to now, because I'm afraid of the floppies, that I'm perfectly fine with grabbing my existing copyrighted software that I've bought off eBay or whatever, stick it in because I want to play my game. So that's floppy disk as input. Floppy disk as output, I'm like, oh, why would I want to save to that? I'm going to save directly to my floppy EMU or an SD card or whatever. I'm going to write to something modern. So I was thinking, like, why do I want to do this? But I can imagine now, right, if I've got a, say I've got a floppy EMU, then that lets me emulate tons of stuff. And if this card supports all those things, I can switch over to whatever, reboot, and now I'm saving to a bigger thing. Or, okay, I can see some use cases. I just didn't understand it at first. Cool.
Yeah.
I agree that there are limited reasons, but
also not everything has to be for me. I was more literally, I didn't understand. Yeah.
As a hobbyist, if you've ever tried to connect one of these drives for whatever reason, insanity or actual practical need, if you one of the first things you'll find on the internet is this Apple II wiki entry. And I don't know if we can share it, but it is just this complex list of what is compatible with what, that, you know, that each different, the UDC and the Liron card and the Unidisk controller and all these things are not perfectly compatible with each other. And it's really very quickly becomes confusing, and you can easily plug a Unidisk into the wrong card and potentially damage it. And the Unidisks are, you know, are a little hard to find. So, you know, I think it's a much appreciated, especially if it comes in at a price point, you know, less than $300, which is, you know, what you're looking at for a Liron card. If it's reasonable, you know, if it's $100 or less, I think there'll be a good number of people who will find this to be a useful item to have. I think a lot of people have stacks of hardware and are happy to connect it. It's, you know, it's easier than SCSI networking, but this will make everything, you know, a lot easier for those of us who are kind of disk drive heads.
Sure. We opened with talking about networking, and one of the types of network we didn't talk about was sneaker net, which still back then and today is such a common way to network things. Just put it on a thing, move it physically over, plug it into your computer. And Jeremy in the chat is saying, like, even though he later comments that he uses Ethernet or USB stick to move things around, he would want 1.0 meg floppy disk support on GS because it's an easier way to just move data from a more modern Mac or PC to his GS. So I do think there's probably a bunch of use cases. I just, you know, I'm slow and you need to explain things to me. I get there eventually.
I think the point that Ian made was that wiki type page that we were talking about with the dizzying array of, you know, variants of Apple 3.5-inch drives and the controllers. Yeah, like I, looking at that and thinking about that, like I take for granted, you know, like I had a Unidisk 3.5 in 1985, and then I remember, like, when I got the 2GS back in the day, it was a modern machine. Oh, yeah, you can't use the Unidisk plugged into it, you know, because it's a different sort of thing. And then I later, more recently, got the SuperDrive, and, of course, that has the SuperDrive controller. So in my mind, I know these things. You know, it's like, oh, I'm not going to, you know, I know here comes someone gave me a new Apple. I know that I need to use this. But if you're coming into it, why would you know? That's crazy to think about. These things look almost exactly the same. Three entirely different protocol, you know, non-related protocols. So, and here's this device that just takes the danger and the mystery out of that. And actually, it seems like these devices like the VidHD and the CFFA, I mean, they're made with modern, you know, microcontrollers, modern hardware. They seem to be almost, you know, across the board, what I consider reasonably priced. Like, I bet, you know, I don't, you know, I'm not, can't speak for, you know, Big Mess Wires, but it seems like, I would guess it'll be well below $300, you know, so it seems like it's also going to be approachable. But who knows? We'll see when it comes out.
And they certainly have a track record for great stuff, like the floppy EMU, which is also, it's $100 or something, is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a, I've just used mine. I have a couple of them, and I used them just, you know, one just today to like boot up my portable. When my SCSI to SD thing was not working. So it worked when the other option didn't, which was amazing.
Can you use it with the Apple III?
The floppy emu, you can, I had a Lyran card in my Apple III at one point. Maybe I still do. I still do, because I have an early version of the floppy emu hanging out the back of the Apple III. So must be connected to that.
That's the crazy question you have to ask about every piece of hardware being released for Apple II. Well, does it work on the Apple III?
That's right.
Well, four people want to know.
Right. But I was going to say, the Elastarn card, the big segment I think that can use that is the Apple IIe users. I mean, like if you want to connect a floppy emu to an Apple IIe, it's what you need. There's almost no other way. There's actually this thing we probably talked about fairly recently. It's a way to repurpose a disk 2 card, I think. It's not a disk 2, but the
disk IO card.
Yeah, the regular sort of disk IO card for the sort of second generation 5 1/4 inch floppies for the Apple II. If you take a printer card and replace its ROM with some other thing that will give it sort of smart port smarts, I think you can plug out a floppy emu into the regular disk card, except that there's an electrical problem that you have to address, or you'll fry your floppy emu eventually. So it's all very complicated. You have to use the right kind of cable with one of the pins sort of removed, or else you're feeding too much electricity into the floppy emu, which will eventually wear it out.
Or a Lyran card. Yeah, or a Lyran card would also,
yeah,
I guess, right?
Right. So if you had a Yellowstone or a Lyran card, then it would work, you know, as designed. Or you could use this little hack, which would work if you remove that pin. So that's I forget. I think this was Kbu HK was the, you know, Kbook, as we sometimes refer to it. Who is, I think, the person who did the W drive, but also, you know, came up with this way to do the adding smart port support in a really sort of genius way, but.
Mm-hmm.
Soft SP, yeah, that's what Jeremy was mentioning in the chat. I think that is Kbook's thing. So,
cool.
All right.
Maybe hazardous anyway to your hardware.
That was actually Big Muscle Wires actually posted something. You know, there's a blog post on the Big Muscle Wires site about this, like, you know, what wire you need to remove, and sort of warning you not to do this unless you've fixed your cable, because otherwise it's going to cause a gradual degradation of your hardware, because it's just sending power where it's not supposed to be, basically.
On a related note, if I may move on to the next news item.
Yep, yours is next, so yes.
I was going to bring back another flash adapter type of piece of hardware that I'm not sure, I might have heard about it first from the retro computing roundtable, and that's the Blue SCSI device. And this device was developed by Eric Helgeson and is readily available as a kit. And why do I need a Blue SCSI device instead of a SCSI to SD, which is another readily available constructed, you know, pre-constructed piece of hardware? Well, basically, this allows you to just put hard drive images on a FAT32 SD card and connect it to your SCSI port, either using a little adapter you can build in the back of your Mac, or, for those of us with old Mac hardware with dead internal hard drives, you can just reconnect a hard drive directly to it. Some of the computers require additional power, which is not very hard to route. But there's a long list of just kind of, you know, sort of almost plug and play computers. I recently built one and put it in a Color Classic, a Mac Color Classic, and it worked relatively easily. I mean, it was certainly a lot easier than getting a SCSI to SD to work, which I spent some time on, and it was, you have to drop an actual SCSI image on the correct size SD card. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's more jumpers and settings, and it's a bit more of a headache to get a SCSI to SD working. And this, I thought, was a pretty smooth operation. I built one and from a kit, and the first time it didn't work, and community on Discord was very helpful. And of course, you know, Eric recommended I take a closer look at my soldering work, and I had missed one solder point, was either poorly soldered or unsoldered, and that's embarrassing after yep. you know, spending a couple hours trying to troubleshoot this. But it ended up being well worth the trouble, because I think it's a great device, and I think it's going to really simplify adding a flash hard drive to old computers. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, we did talk about this before, but without any experience of it, so that's interesting to hear. Yeah, I've been fighting actually with SCSI to SD as well. I have the 5.5 version, which is it's a nice little sort of self-contained one. I mean, I have another one, and I have one of the my next station is running on a internal one. But you're right. I mean, like it has a nice sort of configuration program where you set up all you know, like you can have four devices and they kind of have different SCSI IDs and different, you know, cylinder numbers and that kind of thing. But it's touchy. You know, it's a little tricky. It took me several tries to get this thing to do anything. And so I'm interested in something that is easier to use.
Yeah, a friend of mine in the UK has recently gotten heavy onto the retro computing scene, and he's been really talking a lot on Twitter about the blue SCSI. I know he's using it with like Macintosh classics, mm-hmm. And some LCs, and it sounds like he's really enabled a lot of you know, storage options for him. So yeah, it seems like an interesting new device. Always good to have alternatives, you know, SCSI to SD. A lot of us are using it, but it's the more the merrier.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's one maybe I'll turn to. I wasn't going to talk about this, but this will be my next thing, I guess. Am I next? I don't know.
Sure. Do it.
I'm going to be next. I think I am. Yeah. There, so anyway, let me just put this up here. It's called the RAS SCSI, I think, maybe. This is it's in the same universe. I saw a eBay auction for one of these for quite a lot, actually. It's basically a little hat that you put on a Raspberry Pi to do the same thing. I mean, you know, so it becomes a little SCSI device, and the Raspberry Pi Zero becomes its brain. And so that's, I mean, like an assembled one is $45. And then I don't think that comes with the Pi Zero. Maybe it does. Mm. But so that, you know, again, is pretty achievable price point for such a thing.
Yeah.
And I really do kind of like the idea of being able to just, you know, we can get these cheap Raspberry Pi Zeros. Right. To be able to just sort of like, you know, tack it onto a little hat that gives you the right connector.
Yeah.
So anyway, I would play around with that.
Actually, on that page, you can see the right there on the upper right, that SCSI 50 to DB 25, which is, I believe, what you need if you want to plug one of these devices in externally. And that's another, you know, cute little build. Right. It's some tight soldering points, but it's not hard. And I'm a real hack with a soldering iron, and this was not a real big deal for me to put together.
Oh, you've done this, or you mean you did it for the Blue SCSI?
Yeah, I did it for. I intended to use it for the Blue SCSI, but actually, I thought I was going to have to plug it in externally, and then it started working internally, and then I ended up having this extra board, which again may come in useful at some point as I build another Blue SCSI device. But actually, the forum for the RAS SCSI and the Blue SCSI are, I think they are on Discord. They share a forum.
Oh, I see.
Because I think that they're reasonably similar projects.
Right.
and the people are very helpful. So it's a great place to troubleshoot any issues you have.
Yeah, it's amazing the the Raspberry Pi Zero, some of the things that you can slot it into, and there's the RGB to HDMI Amiga Flicker Fixer, which is just amazing. It's basically Raspberry Pi Zero as acting as a storage frame buffer and input HDMI output. Mm-hmm. Like it's based almost Raspberry Pi Zero is almost free. It's crazy how useful these things are. I like to see every time I turn around, it seems like there's another device using that.
Yeah, I mean if it's got the ability to generate, it can compute quickly. It can have Wi-Fi. It can,
quick enough.
Yeah, it can generate video. On the Raskizzy GitHub site, there's a little chart that shows some of the comparisons between the Raskizzy. When I say Skizzy, I mean Scuzzy. But yeah, like the Raskizzy. Couple different versions, Blue SCSI, SCSI to SD, and I don't know Mac SD, but sort of talks through the kinds of things that they can, the systems you'd put them in and what they can do. Some can do floppies, some can do magneto optical devices. Anyway,
one thing to be aware of though is the thing about the SCSI to SD. SCSI 2 SD is a more mature platform. It's weird to say mature with this kind of thing because even looking on the Raskizzy site, it says like the software is in early stages. It's for early adopters only. Mm-hmm. If you want something stable, we recommend the SCSI 2 SD. So one thing to be aware of is a lot of these are still in development. So if you get one and it's not working, it might not be you. It might not be your soldering. It could be that these things are still getting bugs worked out for them.
Yeah. I think it was 5 years ago that I switched I put a SCSI SD in my Amiga 2000, and that's a while ago. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think putting this SCSI SD in the next station, that required a bunch of very picky parameters to be set. It's old enough that it was merciless on what the geometry of the hard drive was supposed to be, and you had to be able to set it specifically. So, the software, the SCSI to SD software was good enough to do that. So, anyway, there are many options. It'd be fun to try them all.
Yes.
But, are we through? Maybe so. There was one. The thing I was going to say. Let me just. I'll quickly say the thing I was going to say because this came up in the chat actually.
Yeah, I think it's worth talking about.
Yeah, the Defender one.
Yeah.
So this is there's a Defender game that was just released yesterday. it's a Defender port for the Coco 3, and it looks amazing.
Unreal, right?
It looks like Defender. So.
It's using some weird magic to make it look so good.
The Coco 3 is surprisingly capable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So Curtis Boyle has a write-up on his site. The author of the game itself is Glenn Hewlett. Glenn's actually got a YouTube video showing it in operation.
Yeah, basically. That's what I saw first as well. And I was come on. Come on. It's so good.
Yeah, I mean, once it actually starts, there's nothing that tells you this is running on a Coco 3.
Yeah.
It's just a Defender. Other than,
as you could say, the Coco 3 is remarkably capable. That CPU it's got is unreal.
Yes.
But this game is so well done. Oh, my gosh. I'm sure playing this, I would get that experience of being terrible the way real Defender gives me the experience of being terrible at a video game.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know, and of course there was the perfect port of Donkey Kong from a good few years ago now, and I think there's something in between. I think
Joust maybe,
but is it Joust maybe? But yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, that 6809 I've long said that I think, in my opinion, it's arguably the most powerful from a CPU perspective.
Oh, from that 8-bit one, I think by far, absolutely. Yeah. It'd be hard to see an argument otherwise.
And you can replace, for some of the software utilizes, you can replace it with the Hitachi made, there's a super 6809, more or less, and it it even has more power if you swap it out, depending on the software support. But yeah, it's incredible what it has. And I mean, the Coco 3, it has, 320 by 200 has 64 color palette. But it's obviously enough to do these incredible things, especially since you're talking about these are classic games from like the 80s. It's not, you're not doing like 32-bit, photo images. That's not what they're trying to do here.
But it's so good. And the funny thing is my only personal experience with the Coco is like I had my Coco 1 as a kid and I really liked it. Mm-hmm. But I had that Tandy joystick that had no feeling, where the joystick just kind of flopped over, it had no resistance. So whenever I see a Coco game, I think I'm playing it with that little floppy joystick thing.
Yeah.
I'm such a bias because of that. But this looks spectacular.
They had a deluxe joystick.
Absolutely a remarkable port of Defender.
Yeah. Mark in the chat says Glenn has Joust and is working toward Robotron.
Crazy. Coco 3 is such a lovely machine.
Aren't we all?
I'm gonna have to get these on my Coco 3.
Yeah, Mr. Allen has a mysterious comment. It says, got it in under the wire for Septandy.
Septandy. This month, Septandy.
The world revolves around Septandy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I had a coworker bid me a happy Septandy.
Did you really?
Just on Friday.
That's excellent.
He's the one other retro computing nut that I've managed to find in OIT where I work. We're both.
It's funny because Septandy slipped under my radar completely. It was around for years and years and years before I heard about it. So it's got a whole Sam Coupe thing to me where I also kind of think, am I being punked?
Maybe it doesn't really exist.
It's a really thing. Are you all trying to trick me to saying it?
Well, it's because Sam Coupe Timber always grabs your attention over Septandy.
It's been going for years. You just haven't heard about it.
Oh, wow. I like that. Sam Timber.
Yeah, I think it'll be Sam Timber every year now on RCR.
Yeah. That's excellent.
Yep.
Cool. Okay, I think we've made it through news. It's already like hit about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So we can now move to a word from our sponsor.
You are about to witness Sir Clive Sinclair's quantum leap. He's come up with a computer to rival these machines at a fraction of their cost. The Sinclair QL system. With a massive 128K memory, color monitor, and four professional software packages, £698. Phone 200-0200 for your nearest stockist.
In the future, the post office may be obsolete.
Letter? What does it let you do?
Because today there's MCI mail to send mail electronically to anyone, anywhere.
It must have taken forever.
MCI mail can be delivered instantly, in hours or overnight, and can cost up to 90% less than overnight mail.
Life was tough in the old days.
And very weird.
MCI mail, the nation's new postal system.
And we're back. And the host's retro computing gift idea this time is one that that Ian found, actually. So I will hand it over to Ian to tell us about it.
So if I didn't hear about it here, I'm not sure where I heard about it, but it's another product by Backbit.io. And this is a fascinating device. It's called the Chip Tester Pro. And basically, it is a programmable device that has an LCD screen. It allows you to test any number of retro chips, including L-series, memory, processors. I mean, it's got a huge array of stuff. Of course, one of the first things I did was take out a memory chip that wasn't supported. But it's my intention to post on the forum with everything that isn't currently supported. So you can see it's got its ZIF socket lever here, and basically you just you use some jumper wires that it includes, just simple pin jumper wires to power it from these. This is the power array, and literally the LCD tells you exactly what to do. It says plug positive into pin 40, and then it actually checks your work too. So, I mean, it's a kind of a dummy proof, idiot proof device that I'm happy I have. Now, I immediately took out my, you know, pile of chips to test a few things. It seemed to like everything, which made me suspicious because I was sure that I've got to have some bad chips in the pile, but I only tested about 5-6 chips. This thing also has the capability of dumping. Right now it can dump C64 and VIC carts, and I got the adapters to do that. I can follow up with that when I have the chance to dump it. And it has a simple USB power. It comes with cables, you know, 5-volt. And then it takes a mini SD card. If you have to update it, all you have to do is drop a file on the mini SD card. So, I mean, it has all the you choose which chip by just turning the dial and pushing the dial. And it's a really neat little device for people who are playing with or repairing old hardware, especially if it turns out to be, you know, a reliable way, because they do state as a disclaimer that, you know, although it's doing as much testing as it can, some chips are, while they're actually socketed and operating, are going to be used in ways that the chip tester may not be actually testing. Mm-hmm. And they actually, you can actually do testing on chips that are still socketed, the warning that you have to power off the hardware, make sure the hardware is powered off when you do that. So it's an interesting device, and frankly, to me, a major development in retro computing and repair.
This the dumping feature is the thing that is most interesting to me, actually. I would love to be able to do that.
Yeah, I think it actually can do EEPROM dumping too, which I found to be kind of complicated because of the, you know, cheap hardware that I'm prone to buying for dumping EEPROMs or programming EEPROMs. I think it can do both. There's actually another product that that is compatible with this, I believe, that is like a little EEPROM that you can drop in and program. It costs about $20. So I'm not sure if it'll program any EEPROM or if it requires this backbit.io. There they are. Mm-hmm. Talks about the EEPROMs.
Yeah, you can get a cart rip adapter to rip ROM images from a Commodore 64 128 cartridge, a VIC adapter for VIC 20. And then there's a couple of things to replace 24-pin and 28-pin EEPROMs, the CornBit and CornBit XL, which this seems really promising. Like many years ago, I got GQ4X, you know, USB EEPROM programmer, specifically because I wanted to dump EEPROMs, and also possibly burn them myself. And I have never been able to do anything with it because it uses clunky Windows software, and I never want to install Windows. And so this thing that can kind of do it over USB on its own is it's very tempting. Even though someday I sort of feel like I've failed with the GQ4X, you know, I need to succeed with this at some point.
I feel exactly the same way.
Yeah. Anyway, I have a number of things that I would, you know, it's quite possible that many of the ROMs have already been dumped out there somewhere, but I don't know. I mean, there might be some weird version that isn't out there. So I definitely want to have an easy way to do that. And this looks like that might be it for me. And there are only 3 left in stock. It's conceivable soon there will be only 2.
I think she'll make more.
Okay. Yeah, that's I'm more interested in that than any of the gift ideas we've had recently, I think. But okay. Since there are only 3 left, almost everybody will still have money left to buy things from eBay. And so I think, Blake, you can start us off with the eBay auctions.
Alrighty. Well, the first item I have is it's one of the games I play on my retro computers. There's a game called Time Bandit, and I've talked about it before, written by Mitchtron or for the Amiga, for the Atari ST. This was originally, well, actually, it was originally written for the TRS-80 Model 1, and it was then, you know, I think moved from there to the color computer, to the Atari ST, the Amiga. I think the Atari ST version is my preferred version. But anyway, the thing about this is, you know, it's a rather odd port. It's a port for the Sanyo MBC 550 or the 555. And what it is, that's a Sanyo MBC 555 is a rather inexpensive PC clone. Yeah, it's basically a PC compatible, but it's one of those that wasn't really, you know, perfectly compatible. It's like a PC alike. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it has the CGA graphics, I believe. But what it also has is a strange 8-color mode. It's like 640 by 200 in 8 colors. For CGA, you only got, you know, 2 colors in 640 by 200. 200. You only got two colors, but this is 8 colors, and so it's a particularly, you know, particularly good mode for games. And this game that I'm so fond of got a port to that. So it's the Sanyo is kind of a platform on its own if someone's writing, you know, writing for its graphics capabilities. And it's a nice looking version. I'd actually written about the Sanyo version before. I've done a number of blog posts about Time Bandit because I'm fond of it, and, you know, it has an interesting history. But there's actually a YouTube video out there you can find that shows the game running, and so you can see some of the animation. And yeah, the Sanyo, it's interesting. I remember I bought my my first computer was purchased, the TI-99/4A, at a Singer sewing machine shop. Like, they sold like Atari, Commodore. I remember the Atari 800, Commodore 64, the TI, VIC-20. After I got it, and I think I had moved on from the TI to like the Apple IIc at that point, but they continued, and one of the systems they had there was this Sanyo MBC 550, and I played around with it. I don't recall them, you know, having this game for it, but I remember I encountered this bizarre, you know, Sanyo system in the past. So yeah, it's interesting. If you have a MBC 550, 555, this would seem to be, you know, something you would really want if you want to, you know, utilize its unique hardware. And as I recall, the MVC 550, 555 is actually slightly slower. It's like a 8088, but it's slower than 4.77. It's something like 4 megahertz or something. So it's got a lot of things not going for it. IBM compatibility being one, that, you know, it's not that compatible, but there's this lovely game for it. And like, I've twice come close to purchasing a Sanyo 550
just for this game
having the faith that I'll be able to one way or another get hold of this game for it. Mm-hmm. You know, I've played it on the Coco, I've played it on the Model 1, everything, and this is the one version I haven't played. So anyway, I thought that was kind of a unique find. They're actually asking $160 for the floppy. I don't know if it's available like digitally online, or, you know, I've seen the game on eBay once or twice before. But
mm-hmm. One thing just to put in here too, Curtis in the chat said Mitchtron was previously Computer Shack. So you were trying to remember the name they changed from, I think, at one point, and that's what it was.
Yeah, Computer Shack, but there's another name that came that I think after Mitchtron. Was it Microdeal? There's some of the games that came later had a different name. I wasn't thinking of, and I had forgotten about the Computer Shack. But yeah, I knew it as Mitchtron mostly, and I was most interacting with the company and their games when it was known as Mitchtron, when I had the Atari ST. I guess another interesting note I can mention is some of the other games that Mitchtron put out were, I think that, you know, there was Airball. I don't know if we've talked about Airball before. It was another title that came out for the ST and for the Amiga. But there actually was an Apple IIgs version that was written by Jason Harper, who wrote SHR Convert for the Apple IIgs, which is like an extremely popular graphics conversion tool. I think it changed its name and went commercial or something like that later. He was a big, back in the late 80s, Jason Harper was a very well-known, SHR Convert is now called Super Convert. But he did a version of Airball for the Apple IIgs, and it was released, but they sold something like, I think I did an interview with Jason, and I think he said there were 144 copies that he got royalties for. Like, there was no marketing. It was hardly released. There were, there's a box version. I actually ran across an unopened boxed version signed by him, sold by him on eBay, and I grabbed it. So I have it on the shelf. Mm-hmm. I've downloaded it on the GS, and it plays very well with an accelerator. But one of the interesting things is he said basically Mitch Tron was, very difficult to deal with. He'd ask questions, they wouldn't respond. But he mentions in our discussion that he had wanted to do a port of Time Bandit to the GS, and it would have been, in my opinion, one of the better games ever made ever available on the GS. But Mitch Tron did not even respond to the notion. They just didn't answer. So he was sad that he never got to. He was very interested in doing that port. So
he still could.
Anyway, he could. So there's a lot of Time Bandit history for you. But
well, every time I see this game offered online, I think of Time Bandits, the movie, and it gets me excited because I love that movie.
Yep.
But obviously it has no relation to that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And then this is amazing because the NBC 550 was this, I think it's been reported to be the first PC-alike clone because it didn't really have good PC compatibility. It was so early. I don't even think it came with a BIOS. I think that they're like, we have the hardware, but we can't copy this BIOS. We'll get in trouble. I think that was always a big issue for clone makers in the beginning. And so I have one of these units that I picked up a while ago and played with it a bit. It comes with its own proprietary DOS and software and such. Mm-hmm. And it's just another great obscure Japanese mm-hmm. computer that attempted to make headway in the U.S. market without much success. And I'm tickled that there's a game for it. There's also some other crazy Japanese computers that they got publishers to jump on board with that you wouldn't believe existed. I'm trying to remember. I think it was Datamost that did a bunch of ports for the Panasonic JR200. Probably like a dozen or more games for a computer released in the US that nobody knows about.
Because I've never even heard of it before. Mm-hmm.
The JR200, mm-hmm. yeah.
Oh, I know it is. The Sam Coupe. Okay, I see.
Yes.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like the I'm looking, the wiki page actually it is Wikipedia page has some basic information, and it points out much better video display than CGA. It had 8 colors at 640x200 versus CGA's 4 at 320x200. It had a very minimal bootloader ROM that directly accessed hardware to load a RAM based BIOS. So it's definitely not, a typical standard run of the mill, common everywhere later, compatibility. It says it's less, according to the Wikipedia article, it's less PC compatible than the PC Junior. Its inability to use much PC software was a significant disadvantage, apparently, as a PC clone. It's running at, as I was a little bit off, the 8088 in it is not 4.77 megahertz, it's 3.58 megahertz. So it's a full, megahertz, over a quarter slower than the IBM PC. It's just, it's interesting. But that's quite a game for it, and it seems to play at a pretty good speed looking at the video. So, that's very cool that exists.
The same seller actually has a, has an MVC 550. It's, 555? I don't know. It has one of these.
I think it's. Yeah. I think the 555 is simply a two floppy drive version, I believe.
Okay.
It might have more memory or something, but yes, that's correct. The 555 has two. Actually, and interestingly, well, maybe this isn't uncommon. I would have said it might be. Apparently, the MVC 550 and the 555, one or two floppy drives, but they're 160K. So they're single-sided, or, well, I don't know that they're single-sided. The 555-2 has a 360K drive. I thought all 5 1/4-inch PC floppies were 360K. I guess not.
It says on the wiki page that that the disks aren't exactly compatible with PC either.
So it you can't just drop it in.
Oh, that's so cool.
Definitely a PC.
Yeah.
It was the least expensive, according to this, it was the least expensive early IBM PC compatible. So, I might be wrong, but I believe looking at the sketches, there were these an aftermarket seller. Company that I would see in computer magazines, and they sold a computer that looked exactly like this, called the Silver Fox, mm-hmm. and I think it might be the same unit. It certainly is a silver box. It's the color of a 80s stereo deck. I think that might actually be the same computer sold in closeout.
Foxy and boxy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of interesting. That's an interesting little piece. And I have one other eBay item I could go through, unless anybody had any further comments.
Let's see. R2 in the chat says 3.58 megahertz is the NTSC color clock. So that may be a reason for that choice.
Okay.
But that's the only other comment.
Right. Okay. And that explains. Yeah. And the Amiga's 7.16 megahertz is double the NTSC clock. So yeah, that's exactly half the clock of. That was also done for graphics syncing. Interesting. That hadn't occurred to me. Cool. All right. So and the one other thing I had is an item I had never seen before. We're talking about a game that originated on the Tandy, and here is a computer. Sold by Tandy, but not made by them. I'd never seen this before. Vintage Tandy 10, business computer system, Radio Shack, super rare. I think it probably is super rare. It is.
What auction weird is, thing.
It's going for $30,000. It's being sold completely untested since we do not have the power supply sold as is. So it's this weird looking thing. That it's shaped not unlike like a Tandy model, like Model 3, Model 4, with a screen to the left. But it looks like it kind of mated with an HP or something. It's got a smaller than you'd expect
terminal.
Screen to the left. It's got B and C inputs on the front. Or actually, no, they're dials. Sorry, and it looks like it's some sort of a modem controls. There's local, online, offline switches. There's a key control, carrier detect light. So it's like a built-in, whether it's a built-in modem or some sort of telephone-based networking. I had never seen this before anywhere. I'd never heard of it, and I'd never seen physically this unit in a picture. On the back, there are some ports. There's a status connector, keyboard connector that looks unique. CRT connector, despite the internal CRT that looks unique. And there's some switches, toggle switches on the back. Kind of an odd thing. So I looked, how is it? Even like the logo, the Tandy logo on the front. The text looks very wonky. The way the Tandy's written.
It kind of looks a little bit like the Radio Shack logo wound up looking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like
the font. Yeah, font is the Radio Shack font. Tandy 10 computer. So I dug around a bit. Wikipedia. Apparently. The Tandy 10 was released in 1978. It was built for Radio Shack by Applied Digital Data Systems. and it was only sold by Radio Shack's dedicated computer center stores. You couldn't buy it at a mall Radio Shack. I remember we had one Radio Shack computer center store in our, you know, down across town, aside from, you know, the five or so, you know, other Radio Shack stores that sold computers, but they weren't computer center stores. It has an 8080 CPU, 48K memory, 80 column video, two dual-sided 8-inch disk drives, Dartmouth BASIC, and the ADOS disk operating system with optional Fortran 4, or assembly language programming systems. So this is, it wasn't made by Tandy, and it indicates here, reading further, that the original language it contained was actually a form designer. Data was then entered into the form and then sent via RS-232 to a mainframe. Tandy matched it up with Peachtree accounting software in an attempt to market it as a business computer at some point. So, interesting. It did not sell well. It looks like it came before the TRS-80 Model 2 that was, that followed it. So interesting. Had anyone ever seen this thing before?
No.
No one here.
I still have. Because half of it is missing.
Well, that's I'm looking on the TRS80.org site, and it's got photos from the brochure. And yeah, there's like a whole desk part with those big floppy drives, and that's missing from here. So we're really only looking.
It does not seem to have. Yeah.
This thing was a desk.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to have the. There's no internal storage clearly on the device, but it's very weird.
It has some awesome dials on the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the photo I was just looking at.
And if you look, there's for those watching the live stream, the desk is being shown, and it looks like not only are the floppy drives integrated into the desk, the system itself, you can see, is sitting down into like the desk itself. There's clearly a concave space. It's sunken into the desk. Mm-hmm. I know they were big with Tandy made these desks, like the big external drive units that would go. You could get external 8-inch drives for like the Model 2, or the Model 3 and 4 if you wanted, but certainly for the Model 2 and the Model 16. They made a couple of different desks that had like a big, you know, standard desk, but on the right above a drawer was this big open space that was like exactly the size to fit it. Very much like what we're seeing in the image that's being shown here, except you just were sitting an enclosed chassis in that spot. It wasn't as integrated that well. And the reason I'm able to talk about this is one of the, in my computer setup 1 year, I think it was 1985, my parents bought me one of these desks. It was the Radio Shack desk. It had that big space, and I remember I stuck my that huge TI peripheral box down in there, and it was one of those Radio Shack desks. It was built like a tank. They always had an eye towards the desk with some of this big hardware. I guess it started here.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a new one for me.
Who knew Radio Shack was a furniture manufacturer wrapped in a computer and electronics parts?
Weren't they like a leather company originally or something?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they made saddles. Tandy Leather Company. Yeah.
So this comes out in 78. It's only got 48K of RAM, but for the 10 grand cost, you're getting a desk, you're getting both drives, you've got a built-in monitor. This is actually pretty price competitive versus, like, say, putting together an Apple II at the time. Once you've got your whole setup.
8-inch floppy drives?
Right, you get two floppy drives with this. And the monitor. So you get all those cool dials and a whole desk. Weirdly, it looks like, according to the TRS-80 site, they charged – you either had to pay for a local installation fee of $150, which I guess is a delivery, or a maintenance fee. That would range from $100 to $125, I guess, because basically they're shipping furniture.
I think that IBM had the
very cool
service, that service subscription model. that they were probably trying to emulate.
Oh yeah, this is clearly aimed at a business. This wants to say, look at us, we're as cool as a mini computer, but way less expensive, but just as large.
Yeah.
This is a sweet computer. This is neat looking. I don't know anything about that operating system though. I've never even heard of that before.
Someone in the chat, it was mentioned that
ADDS
that apparently competed with the Altair 8800 BT, which was also desk based and had 2 8-inch drives.
Desk based systems.
It'd be a cool thing to collect, because I only collect desk based computers. It'd be awesome.
I don't know why that's so funny. Desk.
Because it's desk not. Based.
I like desktop. Let me clarify.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, wait, you got a new Tandy laptop? No, it's desk based.
You mean desktop?
It is a desk.
Oh no, my friend. Oh no,
it's just desk.
Yeah. Actually, it's desk I do all remember the way a recent eBay not recent, probably about in the last 5 years, an eBay auction for one of these Model 2 recessed desk setups from Tandy, new in the box, and that means it was like a giant, you know, I don't know, 4x8 flat pack that someone was selling on eBay, and it was tempting.
If you have space, yeah.
Well, this seems like a remarkably rare choice, though. I know it's 30 grand on eBay, which seems that's such a valuable thing to be selling on eBay. But this is a crazy rare item. This is rare! !! !! Steve Jobs or whatever. Like this one's super rare. Nice choice. Nice find. Like,
yeah, great stuff. Yeah. Like.
Chat's asking if Earl had that desk when he got his Altairs. If not,
we
will mock him.
I think he did.
No, he got something,
actually,
right?
Yeah, there was something that was in a desk. Cool. So.
Yeah, the Model 2 was the first. The Model 3 was a continuation of the Model 1. Model 2 was a business computer with 8-inch drive on the side. But it had, you could buy this external, chassis.
Yeah, that's the desk I've seen before.
That had up to three 8-inch drives.
I was living the dream.
Yeah, what I'm looking at here is a picture of this. I remember they had these in the 80s in Radio Shack. You'd see them. This is the desk that my parents purchased, you know, for me. And that space, unlike the other desk, you know, this is a chassis you can pick up and take out. But it had that big space for it. So
the guy that drives, you can be a business person doing business computing with your big disks.
Right.
Yeah, it must have been quite a feeling of power to have, like, down, you know, you got the 8-inch drive next to your monitor, then you down there by your knee, you got 3 other 8-inch drives. That's you were a bull geek there. Yeah,
If you were using that setup, you were chained to that computer for 8 hours a day.
Oh, yeah. True. Okay.
There was no fun involved. You were typing in general ledger.
Probably true.
It was all business. That or an IBM Selectric.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's an interesting one. $30,000. I'm not going to bid.
No.
Seems like a lot.
Yeah. It's probably worth it, but yeah, I don't want to spend $30,000 on that incomplete desk computer. But somebody who's gotten just the desk part and the drives is just like, oh, finally.
I'm amazed that in that condition, because that terminal is kind of beat up, that someone kept it. Like, it's lost a few keys, we'll keep it a few more years. It's lost a few more keys, we'll keep it a few more years. You know?
And what they're saying is, like, if you don't bid, I'm going to pluck off another key.
That's right. that's like how
ransom.
You can tell how long it's been on eBay by, like, how many keys are missing.
It started out as a Tandy 30.
The seller has some interesting, like, I was looking to see if he was selling the desk separately, but like I see some 8-inch Ohio Scientific floppy drives in a massive box about the size of a microwave oven. There's some interesting stuff here, and this is like a computer reseller. I mean, it looks like basically the electronics section of a Goodwill, generally speaking, but yeah.
That's cool.
Oh yeah, I've seen this stuff. This is great stuff. That OSI 8-inch floppy, that's so cool. And that one is in the realm of reality for someone who might want to repair one. It's the OSI 8-inch floppy drive for parts is selling for $200. It's a lot, but
if you want it, if you need it, if you're looking for it, it's pretty good. And isn't that nice blue metal chassis?
Good stuff.
Excellent. All right. We'll maybe move on to Carrington. You have the next thing. On topic, even.
I am next. And what did I pick that was on topic? Yes. Okay, I'm sharing this. A couple of choices, the first of which is on topic. I picked this because of the topic of networking. And I like this. I think I don't think it's necessarily worth it, but if you collect new inbox Ethernet things, then here's one. It's an Apple Ethernet NB card, NB standing for new bus. So fun about this is one, Apple calling it the NB card, like they're a bunch of hipsters, too cool to say new bus. What's interesting is if you don't know what you're getting, it would be very easy to think you spend your $75 and you buy this and you're going to stick it in your Macintosh 2 line of computers and you got Ethernet. Technically, yes. But what you wouldn't realize is this is going to use an AAUI port. So when you get this thing and you're expecting to be able to plug in what you think of as an Ethernet cable, oh no, my friend, you need a whole other adapter. Because this comes from the period of time where Apple adopted AAUI to make it easier to make connections. Now, it's weird today. We're all used to RJ45 ports and be able to plug in basically what things look like big phone cables. And there's your networking. But back when there were BNC connectors and T connectors and everything was a little more difficult to connect, there was the AAUI standard port. And Apple decided to put out their Apple AUI, the AAUI port, a smaller, slightly easier to use port.
And incompatible.
And incompatible with everything in the freaking world. And we lived in this period of like 8 years where everything had an adapter, which I say for 3 years, as if that's not Apple today. So Apple does love to put out things that require adapters. So this is from that period. So easily you could think you'd buy this card. If you look it up, you read about it, you think, I want to add my Ethernet to my 2FX. This would work fine. It fits in your NewBus port. But then you will need another adapter. You will need an AAUI to RJ45 adapter to actually use it.
And it's one of those adapters that people gleefully threw away.
Yep.
Yeah.
I will never want to see this again.
Right. And so you'll spend $75 for this card. And it's only that much because it's new in box. You can get cheaper Ethernet cards for that period. But I try to pick collectible things. And so this is a nice new in box from that period where they're all gray boxes. A lot of stuff would come in this period at an Apple store in a baggie with just a gray brown construction paper top all stapled on it. So this is from that period where they were, going through this weird brown construction box packaging. So it would work fine. But so that was my first choice because it was on brand and I wanted to talk about the AAUI and its awfulness, horror stories from that. And my second two choices, little cheap things, which are not vintage things, but they're kind of neat, little edge-lit signs. So I've got one for Acorn and one for Apple II, same seller. And I think they're interesting because right now they're £15, so they're cheap. But that's the opening bid. If they went for a lot, it probably wouldn't be worth it. But they're neat little acrylic edge-lit signs. So an Acorn one in green, an Apple II one in pink, and they run off USB. So that tells you how old they are. They are not old. These are not in all vintage things. But for £15, for roughly $20, they'd be a neat thing to have. Like if you were an Acorn collector and you wanted this plugged in behind, get a glowing Perspex sign. I think that's kind of neat. Or get the pink one for the Apple II. I think they'd be fun little devices, signs to have. Little glowing Apple II signs. If they go for cheap, totally fun and totally worth it. I mean, certainly not a thing you should drop $100 on, I think. But if you're the only bidder, this would be a fun thing to have.
I know there are, and I've been thinking about this recently, because I have a fan next to me that is blowing a cool breeze, and it is USB powered. And I know USB. The wattage, like the voltage. You don't have to there are so many proprietary barrel type power supplies and this and that for all the devices. But I can't get comfortable with using non-data things powered by USB.
Nope.
Am I the only one?
You are the only one.
I am. Yeah. Okay. Because USB ports are everywhere, and it makes it easier, I guess, but it just feels wrong. I don't know. But you guys are all good with it.
Yep.
Yeah,
well, speaking of fans powered in funny ways, but it's not that funny, there was a seller that had Apple II cards with fans on them.
And oh, yes, just a fan. Yeah.
That's a cooling device, but it's they didn't sell out quickly. let's just say. Because yeah. I think it is an awkward proposition that you have a slot dedicated to your fan. Maybe you need it, but not generally.
Mm-hmm. Also, that seems a little like it's unnecessarily taxing your power supply. I mean, if you have a CFFA 3000 and a VidHD in there, those are already drawing a lot of power right. on that power supply. You don't also want to be spinning a fan.
Yeah, that's true.
That's it. Easy but, choices. Yeah. That's what I got this week.
Yeah.
I think we had we saw somewhere sometime in the not so distant past a similar kind of Apple II card, which what its whole role was to power a Raspberry Pi. It wasn't actually connecting any pins to the data or anything like that. It provided power to a Raspberry Pi that was physically located inside your machine. It's like, wow. What is the point of that? I don't know.
Or there's also a card that someone sells that just has a digital readout of the power output of your Apple II.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although, I could see track. That. I could see that being sort of useful. Okay, you can see like how much power you have left, basically, before you overtaxed the thing.
Right.
I was in a discussion on the Slack looking at talking about, you know, the CFFA and the VidHD, and someone posted a spreadsheet of like measured, it's not every device, but measured interface cards and how much they draw. And I was under the impression that the VidHD and CFFA, because they were, you know, made with modern hardware microcontrollers, that they pulled very little power. No, it's amazing how much power like the CFFA pulls. It's astonishing. It's many, many times more than like a disk II adapter or something, like 10 times, 15 times more, I think. I didn't realize.
I mean, I didn't realize that until sort of recently either. And it does make me wonder about like putting both. Like I was thinking about experimenting with a VidHD and the Apple III at one point, and but the idea of like sending, you know, 10 times what normally should be going over those power buses across them doesn't seem like maybe such a good idea, even if the power supply can handle it.
Yeah, but, 10 times easy.
Yeah. All right. Cool. I guess we can move on to your eBay auctions.
So the first item is just this. It's just a 3.5-inch floppy cleaning kit, and there's nothing too special about this kit. But it is my opportunity to remind everybody with a 3.5-inch drive: don't open it up and expect to clean those heads, especially the Apple drives. I don't know much about cleaning the heads of PC drives. You really just have to use a head cleaning disc. It's just too easy to bend the mechanism that applies pressure to the disk and mess up your drive. So never clean it with a Q-tip, never clean it directly. Always use one of these head cleaning floppy disks. You don't have to use the fluid. I think isopropyl is fine on one of these. And you can use one of these disks practically forever, unless it gets super gummed up. You can use it for a good amount of time, at least. The 10 cleans that these floppy disk cleaning kits recommend is way fewer than the 100 or 200 that you probably will get out of this floppy cleaning kit. It's just a 3.5-inch disk that contains a fabric floppy disk alike that spins in the drive. You can use it dry or use it with a little isopropyl or the included mystery poison solution. But don't forget. Never forget.
Yeah.
Don't open up that drive and clean it.
Definitely, if you're sort of used to the disk II, I mean, like that you know, you can just freely, you know, pop the little pressure thing up and wipe it off with a Q-tip and put it back down. But the thing with the 3.5-inch drives is that if you pop the thing up, it will never come down again. I mean, like it's you've bent it up and it is no longer applying pressure.
Yep.
I didn't realize how tough those 5.25-inch disk II drives were until I saw 4 a.m. cleaning one by, let's just say, applying some moisture to his thumb and wiping the head off with his thumb. That was his idea of cleaning the drive head. And that did not destroy the drive. You know, it resulted in thousands more cracks.
Yep.
And The next item I wanted to bring to everybody's attention is this these replacement power supplies that Jay Newirth has designed for Model 4 and Model 3 computers. This is interesting. The one that we're showing right now, we're showing a list of the sellers, which is really, I believe, Jay Newirth, his wares. And he's got a bunch of neat items that he's created for Model 3, Model 4, and TRS-80 computers. So he makes a modern switching power supply for Model 4 and Model 4P, which I guess I was surprised that they shared the same power supply. I bought one of these to install in a Model 4 that that is sitting in parts on the floor. I couldn't get the cabling to work. It seemed like the power supply was meant to be upside down from where it was. Well, apparently, little did I know, there are two variants of the Model 4 TRS-80, which one would require the power supply to be upside down. So I asked Jay about it on Facebook, where there was a thread about it, and he actually has a had just created a separate mounting kit I look forward to trying out to mount this thing essentially upside down. But I'm very excited because these power supplies, since they power both a motherboard and a monitor, tend to have a lot of caps. And so a lot of opportunities for me to mess up a recapping job. He also looks like he's doing one for the Model 3. I don't have a Model 3 accessible right now. It's in storage, but I'd probably get it for that. And he also has some great little miniatures that are something like $20 that are they're Carrington sized.
That is really quite cool.
Yeah, that is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm tempted by this 4P thing. The Model 4P power supply. I'm hoping there's only one version of that. I have 4P and it's currently working, but I do worry about power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could contact Jay directly on Facebook and ask him, but I don't believe there's a variant, but I am certainly not a TRS-80 Pro. That being said, I have a Model 2, a Model 4, and I just finished fixing up a Model 1 for repairs, but, you know, do my best.
Cool.
And on to the next item. I saw these Southwest Technical Products tapes. I've never seen any of these offered. This is a lot of SWTP, Southwest Technical Products cassette software. Some of it looks original, like this basic 4K. A couple of things look original. But, you know, it's probably someone's typed in code. It brings to light the one of these obscure computer companies from the 70s called Southwest Technical Products that is out of nearby San Antonio, or that was out of nearby San Antonio. And another fascinating company that that actually started in the 60s making kits for popular science and ended up in the 70s making kit computers that were based around 6800s. And I've attached a couple of videos about Southwest Technical Products. Here's one from one of my favorite channels, Look Mum No Computer, which in general is about taking old technology and repurposing it or using it to make music. But this one deviates slightly from that, where they just show, you know, starting up and fixing up one of these computers. But, you know, there's just a few videos about these Southwest Technical Products computers, and they're pretty cool. You know, they've got the classic 8-inch drives and, actually, I think there was I'm not sure if it was a proprietary operating system, but the gist of the computer is, you know, it's a Altair-like box on the side of a very cool-looking, you know, 70s terminal, and then a separate, you know, 8-inch drive chassis. A lot like the Tandy 10 we talked about. But probably a little sexier looking the terminal. So these things look like good fun and probably beyond my ability to dedicate the time to it. Another cool company, kind of like OSI, Ohio Scientific, that, you know, that sort of disappeared with time quickly in the PC market. But I thought that was a cool lot of cassettes I've never seen before. I might even just put in kind of a low bid with the hopes that I could grab some and eventually archive them if they're not already saved. So kind of neat.
Yep.
And then the last item that is a lot of user group magazines or zines that and that already ended at relatively high, but real neat group of a lot of San Diego Atari zines. And I just love that I'm actually from San Diego, and I just love to see these things I had no idea existed. But San Diego was a pretty high-tech corridor, and these are just such neat, you know, local, even pretty well-done zines, user group magazines mm-hmm. or newsletters. And I'm always excited to see the local user group newsletters.
I'm pretty impressed at how high that got. This ended at 157.50,
I agree.
Which is, it's a bunch of paper, you know, with outdated information on it. But it probably is, you know, the kind of thing that, you know, only a very small population had, and most of them threw away. So hopefully whoever got it will scan them.
Yes.
Or if you had something published in one of these things, if you knew somebody,
yeah.
I could see really wanted to get a copy of. Like I used to do zines years ago, mm-hmm. comedy ones, poetry ones, like zines all over the place during my punk days. I don't have copies of any of those things. Something like that came up on eBay, I would be bidding hard to get back a thing I made. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that often happens with, you know, like people will contact, you know, authors of a game or whatever, and they're like, I haven't had that for 25 years. all right, let's see. I have some in the list. I'm not sure I will talk about all of them. But, okay, this came up to the this is an auction for an Apple PowerMac G4 Cube power adapter. And I only just basically, you know, I pointed this out only because these things are just a pain, and I do kind of wonder if there's a way that we can get around that. Hopefully there is, but the G4 Cube has a dedicated special power supply. It is it has a particular, let's see, where's the specifications on it? It's like 205 watts. So it's like some you know, strange amount of power, and it has a special adapter, you know, a special end on it. And, you know, so if you have a cube, you need one of these things, and they can fail. So and they are expensive as a result. So this one is $150. Buy it now. I have a cube. I have such a power supply. I have it when it's plugged in, it gets warm and makes me nervous. Anyway, so the next thing actually I wanted to talk about, so this turned out this thing got sold between, you know, last night and tonight, when we're talking about it now, but it's a Copy 2 PC option board. Does anyone know what this is?
I've heard of it. I've heard of it from Central Point.
Yeah, I mean, I have one of these, and uh-huh. It was probably, you know, one of the better ways to back up almost any disk at one point. But now we have, you know, far better hardware with Applesauce and all the other Flux imaging projects. But I mean, I like this kind of stuff that, you know, it's like the wild card for the PC mm-hmm. or, you know, which is the wild card being an Apple II piracy expansion card. I more like this stuff than understand exactly what the point of it is. I know that at one point it was what you had to have to back up certain PC software. But then I also thought that most PC software was not copy protected for hard drive installation. So it seems almost redundant that it exists.
Yeah, so I also have one of these, partly you know, just because of it's really it, basically what it is an EDD card for the PC. So the Central Point made a card called the Essential Disk Duplicator card, which was a way to basically read it read at high resolution, higher resolution than the normal disk 2 would, and so it's a little bit like an early applesauce. You know, I mean, the EDD card was the thing everybody was using to make images of Apple II discs up until the applesauce existed, and then it became entirely obsolete. So this was the PC version, and in fact, actually, you could use the copy to PC option board to image Apple II discs also, and they had added advantage that the PC drives could tell where the disk was rotationally. So like there's a little index hole in the disks that would say like I'm passing this same point over and over again. The PCs could read this, the Apple II could not. So there was actually even a slightly better way to make EDD images of your Apple II discs if you only cared about the front side. So anyway, it's kind of interesting because it was from the time, you know. So it says on it. Let's see. Well, I guess it doesn't. I guess what I thought it said on it was that you could back up Apple II discs, Mac discs, Commodore 64 discs. But what it's actually saying is this company makes things for all those platforms.
So, right.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought it's interesting. This over that past 24 hours sold for $187. So somebody else thought it was interesting too.
Have you heard of, you mentioned the EDD and what's the other Apple II card you mentioned?
Wild card.
Yeah. The wild card. I'm just looking at the documentation now, that I found online, at Apple2Online.com. I had an Alaska card, which is also from Central Point Software. I don't know if anyone has heard of it. I guess you have.
That's another one of the sort of like NMI cards, right?
Well, the thing about the Alaska card is, and as it's, I remember using it, and I see it described in the manual. It will copy memory resident programs, but so it dumps memory to floppy, but apparently most of the items that did this would only dump the lower 48K. This will handle 48K, 64K, and 128K on the 2E. If the thing, you know, whatever's in memory, like if it's, I remember I was able to copy Chuck Yeager's Advanced Flight Trainer was a flight simulator from EA, and it happened to load entirely into memory if you had 128K, and I was able to make a copy of it with that and a few others. But of course, many games and programs aren't fully, you know. But I bought this from some guy. I saw it listed in the local newspaper, like the classifieds, and I went and it worked out. I only now realize it was from Central Point Software. I don't think that was clear, and I don't believe it was marked on the board that it was CPS.
Yeah.
Similar, well, kind of.
Same, you know, endeavor to try to back up things that they don't want you to back up.
All right.
Okay, let's see. I think, what else do I want to mention? So this is an auction for 1984 computer with email using MCI services. How do you pronounce this? Sidereal?
Sidereal, yes, what I would say.
Yeah. It's something astronomical. It's Sidereal Corp Micronet 12. What it is a terminal that was basically for MCI mail. And so I didn't know very much about MCI mail. It seemed like this is one of these things that I kind of missed. But apparently this was kind of it was actually sort of integrated with physical mail. Like the idea is that you could use MCI mail to kind of send, like I think they would print out and deliver a message that you sent over MCI mail to someone else. So these terminals weren't, I don't think they were supposed to be generally like things people had but this is sort of like more things companies had. Does anyone know anything about MCIML?
Not really.
Yeah.
I'm having a slight flashback just saying MCI as a provider of long distance calls and phreaking and phone phreaking and, you know, and bizarre, outdated communication methods.
Yeah, I do remember. I do remember MCI having a 5-digit code that was not particularly hard to just guess. But at any rate, I thought it was sort of interesting as a thing. I mean, like I think it's just a terminal that has at least a little bit of built-in sort of ROM for MCIML. And I had looked up a little bit about the history of MCIML, and it did seem like it was before there was email, and it was really, at least in part, using physical, like the physical medium. You would send something to a center, and then they would print it out and deliver it, until it all fell apart when the faxes came. And, you know, then there was no need for an intermediate office.
Sort of a telegram service.
Yeah.
It was definitely an email type thing where it would stay digital. Because I remember a time where there was a big announcement that you could use MCIMail to send to things like CompuServe and stuff. So MCIMail user could send it to a CompuServe user and they'd get it in their CompuServe mailbox. But that's like the only thing I remember about MCIMail was that announcement.
That seems like, that should be an obvious next step. I mean, like the idea of sort of sending something electronically that you could then print out and hand to somebody feels a little crazy. But I mean, like, not many people had these terminals, right? So
one needs to buy the computer, dump the ROM, and then put it on MAME, another thing that belongs on MAME.
Right.
Or set up like a short-run telegraph service at Kansas Fest or whatever, so you can send mail through this, it'll print it out, we'll deliver it to the person's room.
Right. Yeah, I think that there needs to be some sort of a reprintable paper or something so that you could print on the paper, but then you could use it again.
Yeah. Well, fax papers like that heat stuff, it goes blank. Could I put that back in?
Yeah, as long as you could
do that it thermal again, paper.
Yeah. Okay. I think I'll leave it at that since the time is dramatically ticking by. So, we can now, I guess, move to closing discussions. Blake, you are alphabetically first.
Alphabetically first. Not a lot to report or discuss in closing, I suppose. I'll keep my eyes out for more desk-based computers until next year.
The collectibles of the future.
Yep, indeed. So, who else might have a more interesting closing remark?
Well, Carrington is next in the list.
Well, I'm going to let you down. I've done almost no retro stuff for the last 2 weeks, but I've been doing I think I mentioned previously, my girlfriend and I, she lives in Canada, you wouldn't know her.
Check.
Right. bingo card complete. We've been doing a lot of virtual escape rooms as the pandemic moves on to year 7 or whatever. And so last night we did a fun local one, which is like a scavenger hunt using a software called Goose Chase or something. And so somebody sets up these haunted scavenger hunt things where you go to a certain place and you have to unlock certain things by your GPS and do codes and collect water and chant things. It was super, super fun. And tonight we're doing an escape room that's in Japan. So it starts at like 9:45 tonight or something and goes for 2 hours, some 2-hour virtual escape room that we're hoping, their website has some English on it. So we're hoping that the host will speak some English, but we will see. So I'll be doing a lot of that stuff still. I do love escape rooms.
Nice.
We've run out of escape rooms in North America. We're now just branching out.
Right.
Yep.
Ian, do you have any closing thoughts?
Yes. Just hoping to finish up some TRS-80 stuff. Try to get my Model 2 working. I recapped that one. It was like a 35 caps. I don't know. And now it doesn't work.
Oh.
So I have to do more testing. Turns out
it was 36.
Maybe pull out the power supply again, which is like limbo around a tube. I have to discharge a CRT. It doesn't sound like fun. But got to try. And then I have that Model 4. I got to try the mounting. I just redid a power switch on a Model 1. Those TRS-80s are very demanding.
Yeah, and you have, what, like 4 days left before the end of Septandi. So.
This is really a lot of pressure.
That's right. Let's see. For me, I mean, I guess I already sort of talked about it. Like, I've sort of been setting a lot of things up, and it's been kind of fun, you know, just sort of like getting all the computers to power on. The Raspberry Pis are amazing.
yes.
Though, actually, there was one thing that one. It turns out that, you know, software keeps like updates keep advancing, and not all. Yeah, you know, we've talked about, like, you know, if you don't buy a thing when it's made, it might go away and that sort of thing. But there's sort of a similar thing that happens in the software realm too. So A2 server, A2 cloud, these things, you know, run on Raspbian, and, you know, they're sort of like utilities that you put on a Raspberry Pi to give you sort of various nice features for an Apple II. But there have been two updates in the sort of, you know, Debian base, and I can't make them go. I can't install them. So I might be spending my October retro challenge trying to make these go if I can do that. Because
or reach out to Ivan somewhere, see if he wants to make an update.
Yeah, somewhere I had like a SD card that had a working, you know, install from two iterations ago. But the thing is, it's not just that I can't just install an old version of Raspbian, because they don't, like, I can't pull down the all the dependencies, and there are hundreds, you know, anymore. So anyway, whatever. That's what I've been doing. That's what I will probably still be doing for a little while. All right. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. Also, actually, if you wanted to join our Facebook group, stop dancing, everybody. But answer the questions, because it turns out that for some reason there's like a bunch of someone has created a whole lot of like fake accounts. I don't know what's going on with that, but at any rate, so if you tried to join the Facebook group and were banned, but because we thought you were a fake account, send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We will try to set you up. But and don't be a fake account. Okay, anyway, we're a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Write a review on iTunes if you want, saying, they banned me from the Facebook group. They thought I was a bot. or whatever. But, and until next time,
Retro Compute.